Hello, everybody. Very impressed. Sunday night. A long day. You did a lot already. You should be proud of yourself, whatever you did already on Sunday. Whatever you accomplished was great. Whatever you accomplished already was great. And now you're going to end it off in a really meaningful way. So last year, we had the very special privilege to launch B'chol Nafshecha, the Young Israel of Teaneck Mental Health Initiative. I don't need to explain to anybody in the room why there's a need for an initiative like this, what's going on in the world, what's going on in the Jewish community. We need to address these types of issues. And the initiative has been a very special way to address all kinds of different things. And the goal was to provide education, certainly on specific topics, but really, the honest truth is that maybe most importantly, to continue to chip away at whatever stigma still exists and does still exist on mental health challenges in our community and in the world in general. So last year we talked about issues that related more generally to children as they address different stages of life. And this year we decided to focus more on very specific topics beginning tonight. I want to thank Shani Barber, Judith Sucker, and Lisa Heller, each of whom are expert clinicians in their own right, who agreed to take time out of their very, very busy schedules to sit on the B'chol Nafshecha committee, framing the vision for the general initiative and certainly for this lecture tonight. And in particular, I want to thank Shani for being the quarterback for this evening's event. The issue of body image is an extraordinarily important one, and it impacts our community, we'll find out, as much, if not more, than in the general community. And I think it's one that's not well understood. I know that just from my own life. I know it from conversations I have with people all the time. It's not a topic that we like to talk about, and it's not one that we understand well. And that's why I'm so glad that we have the opportunity to hear this evening from somebody who really understands it very well. It's a little bit of deja vu, as we had the zechus to have Dr. Rohrer here last year. Last fall, and Dr. Rohrer was so well received that we said we should bring her back. And in particular, because this is her area of expertise. Dr. Rohrer is a psychologist with a PhD in clinical psychology from Yeshiva University's Furkoff Graduate School of Psychology. Her area of focus, both in research and clinically, is in the field of eating disorders. Her previous clinical experiences include work at the Ramaz School, the Renfrew Center of New York, St. Luke's Obesity Research Clinic in New York, and Hadassah Ein Kerem in Jerusalem. Sarah's area of research has focused on binge eating disorder, emotional eating, and night eating syndrome, a subject on which she has published articles as well as presented at the Academy of Eating Disorders in 2008 and 2014. She's presented at a number of conferences as well as area day schools and high schools. Dr. Rohrer maintains a private practice in Manhattan, and Dr. Rohrer's reputation precedes her as one of the go-to therapists in the New York, New Jersey area for teens. And for anyone struggling in this area, and it's a great, great honor and privilege to introduce Dr. Sarah.
Thank you so much. First of all, that was not a modest introduction. First of all, thank you so much for having me back. It is such an honor and a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Rabbi Krohn. Thank you to the committee. Thank you to Shani. First of all, you make it so easy. This was like, we were just saying four text messages back and forth. Hopefully we will, in those four text messages, have covered what people are interested in hearing tonight. It's really like an honor for me to be able to be here and speak and share and collaborate together. I keep thinking I haven't been doing this for so many years, and then I have these moments where I'm like, oh, I guess I've been doing it for a lot of years, but I always feel like I'm growing and learning and collaborating, and so I'm excited to be here tonight to share and think together and share a little bit of what I have to offer, and hopefully people will feel like they can collaborate and share back. So I have a presentation. We'll go through some of it. Maybe we'll get to all of it. If you feel like there's something that's on your mind, that's a question that we're hitting, we're not getting to, you want to ask a follow-up, I love collaborating more than I love speaking. Although my sister-in-law's in the room, she might disagree. But but I really and truly am excited to hear what people have to think about this. I had an idea a little bit of where I wanted this conversation to start, and then it happened that I was thinking about something and I totally switched gears completely. So I want to share something that kind of got me to where I wanted to start tonight. So a while back, if people remember, there was COVID. And when we were in COVID, people didn't leave their homes as much as they do now. We would not all be sitting here today. And there were a lot of things that were hard about COVID, and there were a lot of things that were sad about COVID. And different families had different environments that worked for them. But one of the things that I realized in COVID was that there was something about Shabbos morning that shifted and changed, and some l'tov and some l'ra, some for good and some for bad. We miss going to shul and seeing people, but I also treasured the slow pace that happened on Shabbat morning. And one of the things that I discovered was that on Shabbat morning, I loved meeting up with friends and going walking. I was busy during the week and I didn't get to see a lot of friends. And I found a Shabbat morning walking partner that we would go and we would meet every Shabbat morning and we would walk. But then COVID stopped and everybody went back to shul. But I really liked my Shabbat morning walking partner. And at that point, there was a little more pieces to tussle. My husband was going back to shul, and I still really enjoyed meeting friends. And so what sort of ended up developing is that Shabbat morning, early, with some minor tweaking and permutations as it goes, I would go walking after I daven shachrit, actually Shabbat morning with friends. And that's still to this day. At 8 o'clock in the morning, I meet two friends of mine. My original walking partner moved to Florida, and I picked up two very close friends, walking partner. And sometimes I meet them halfway, and sometimes they can't come, and sometimes it all depends. But what's become a ritual is that as I'm walking to meet them, especially since in the last year, I'm pretty careful about how much news I consume. I consume a lot of Israel news during the week, pretty measured, but I don't consume a lot of regular news. But Shabbat morning, as I'm walking to meet my friend, I take the Friday Wall Street Journal. So I am completely uneducated about anything going on in the world other than what is in the Friday Wall Street Journal. And what usually happens is I read the Friday Wall Street Journal until I meet my friends, and then I put it away. And then I walk home into the house, and I've discovered amazing things about the world, like anything business-related. I walk in the door, and I usually look at my husband, who's leaving at the same time. I said, "Do you know?" He's like, "I love this ritual." So this Shabbat morning, I walked into the house and I said, "You don't even begin to know what's going on with your particular business." He's like, "I promise you I do." He's like, "I love this ritual and I promise you I do." But there was something in the Wall Street Journal that jogged my mind that made me shift gears completely. There was an article that basically there is a company in Finland that startups do a lot of meetings. They have a lot of meetings. They have meetings, and most of the time when they meet over eating and drinking. But there's, in the startup world, been a shift where they don't want to meet around drinking. There's been a movement towards lowering the amount of alcohol that people take in. And in Finland, what they decided to do is they meet in saunas, like hot boxes, like saunas. And the idea was to bring this to a large VC conference in San Francisco. But one of the things they struggled with was they had two separate problems. One was they recognized that in Finland, this is what the article said, in Finland, body image is much more secure. I'm not sure the statistics bear out on that. I did a little digging, but that was what he proposed compared to Americans. And he didn't think people were going to want to sit in a sauna with a bunch of other people in bathing suits. That was problem number one. And when they proposed it to the Wall Street market, they said, "Listen, this might be a great idea, but there is no way we are going to have professional meetings with people sitting in bathing suits. That's not a thing. That's like not happening." And what they designed was a bathing suit for meetings in saunas, which was basically like swim guide, basically, like full rash guard. And that would be appropriate attire. And as I'm reading this, what I found really fascinating was a couple things. One was I loved this idea that they were putting out there that people in different communities and different environments are self-conscious. It brought an article that I had just read and was recently published in the Journal of Eating Disorders that people who feel more confident about what they're bringing to the table from an intellectual perspective are less self-conscious about their bodies as a whole. It was an interesting thing to think about in terms of the fact that like attire, where we are in time and space, is really different in terms of what we're trying to put out there into the world. But the other thing that I found so fascinating, they weren't trying to get rid of eating. This was specifically designed as a way to lower alcohol intake, something that we think about a lot in our communities today in terms of ourselves, our teenagers, but also the fact that it wasn't about reducing the amount of opportunities that people have together to eat. And one of the books that I love as it relates to eating disorders, so it kind of hit all the buckets. I was like, this was dropping me down an interesting conversation around when we think about body image and sense of self and how we present ourselves, both in the real world and the here and now, acknowledging the body image, acknowledging the fact that we are so much more and that people who feel like they want to portray themselves with so much more are able to negotiate out that body image. And then there was this aspect that we come back to over and over and over again, which is coming together around food and eating is really a wonderful experience, and nobody wants to get rid of it, nor we should. And Cole Kasdan, who writes a fabulous book, she writes an autobiography, but it's interwoven in the autobiography is a book about eating disorder treatment today and body image and self-esteem. She has such a fabulous line. She quotes I actually don't know who he is, but she quotes Chris Moore. He's the founder of Nutrition Consulting Company, and he says, if you want to look at pizza as just breaking it down into its nutritional values, you can, and you might come to the conclusion that maybe it's healthy, maybe it's not. We can argue about what that means, healthy, not healthy. Put that aside for a second. He's like, but if you consider the fact that that's not what it's about, it's about people coming together to sit around and enjoy each other's company, that's an amazing thing. And one of the things we've lost in so much of these discussions as it relates to food and as it relates to body image, because the two become connected, is we're focused on the thing that we're eating instead of the person that we're talking to. And how do we come together and think about not just who we're talking to, but who we are as ourselves, as somebody we want other people to talk to? And that's kind of where I think about when I launch the discussion of like self-esteem and body esteem. And the piece I always come back to over and over again, so anybody who's ever heard me speak, listened to me speak, I always start with Anna Quindlen. I've moved over the years. My most favorite Anna Quindlen is the next slide. But this Anna Quindlen is an amazing, her whole speech is amazing. I recommend looking it up and reading it start to finish. I just put a small quote. Anna Quindlen is an author. She writes a lot about body image. And she was giving a speech for commencement at Mount Holyoke. And she said, what I want to say to you today is this. If this sounds in any way familiar to you, you can read it. But basically what she talks about is that if you go through the whole world and every time you go, you're trying to figure out how to morph yourself into the scenario you're in because that's the thing you're supposed to do, you're going to find yourself ultimately very, very, very empty in life. And I just want to go back to one other piece as it relates to this idea of coming around the table to sit. You know, Drisha Tarab, this past week's Parsha, when we were talking about, there's a lot of food. There's a ton of food in this week's Parsha. I don't know if anyone noticed, there's a lot of food opportunities happening. But one of the opportunities that wasn't so positive is that Rashi points out that when Lot's wife turns into salt, it's because she was angry that Lot offered the guests salt. Like, it was one thing just to give them food, but you had to give them salt also. Like, that was like a real insult to injury, that like, that's truly hachnasat orchim, and like, why did you have to do something like that? And I'm sure somebody else much smarter than me has already said this, but it feels to me such a, like, out there for the taking, salt enhances food. Salt is about coming together and enhancing food, like actually being together and enjoying each other's company. And that's really what Hachnasat Orchim is about. And that's what we're going for, right? Really trying to sit around a table and enjoy each other. It comes up, interestingly enough, with a lot of different ways we think about actually Judaism in food. There's some interesting studies I'll kind of touch on more later, but there is some interesting studies to look at in terms of Ashkenazic history and Sephardic history that anybody who knows me knows the PhD is a little bit of a fake. I hate writing, I hate dissertations, so I always say to my supervisor, I should really write something on this, but I hate writing, and she's really good at writing, so she always says she'll help me do it, but I hate research and writing, so I haven't. But there's an interesting discussion because in the Ashkenazic world where they were constantly being chased, there's a lot of discussion of epigenetics and what genetics and the Ashkenazic community has done. We know there's a higher rate of eating disorders. We see it in the Holocaust, but I think it existed prior. Versus the communities that originated from Spain, by and large, had the Spanish expulsion, but then were very settled, and they lived a very, by and large, a wealthier life, and their food is manifest of that. If you look at the cultural food that's come out of Ashkenaz and the Sephardi worlds, I'm a little biased because I'm Sephardi, but by and large, the Ashkenazi world is a little more like a lot of times a lot of poor food, right? Things that can go a farther distance. And Sephardi food is a little bit more, you sit around, you drink a cup of coffee. It's a bit of luxury. And so there's an interesting discussion about where those rates kind of fold in. But I think it is really, just going back to this piece for a second, this idea of really trying to help ourselves, our children, become who they are because they want to become that person, not because they're trying to fit in. And that's a really hard thing to do. And that's why we're going to see eating disorders and body image vulnerabilities crop up in moments where they're trying to figure out who they're supposed to be and how we can help validate them to find their voices and find themselves and not just follow the tide. And that's a hard thing to do. But I think that's where you see a lot of those vulnerabilities. That doesn't mean that every single person, I think this is an important piece, every single person who struggles with body image and body esteem is going to go on to have an eating disorder. We know that, right? Most people are not always secure in their body image, and that's an okay thing. The question becomes, how do we talk ourselves? How do we talk our kids? How do we role model for ourselves, our kids, the world? How to navigate that so that they come to a place that's healthier and not landing in a place that's eating disordered, even though we know there are so many other vulnerabilities when it comes to eating disorders, genetics, etc. This was the original quote. The original quote is this idea of doing everything perfect your whole life and doing it all right, but then you don't because we can't, because none of us can. It's not possible. It's impossible to do everything right. We're not supposed to. But then when you've done everything right and then somehow it doesn't follow through for you, you have to look inside yourself and realize, was I doing it for me or was I doing it because it was all supposed to go right? And the minute that it doesn't, things start to fall apart and you don't know where that's going to be, right? It could be that it goes right up until your 30s or 40s or 50s, and then something happens, but it always happens. If you don't have a core to come back to, then you find yourself feeling very, very kind of empty and lost. And that's where we see that sense of like, I don't know who I am, and I don't know what I'm putting out there, and I don't feel so good about it. And if I don't feel so good about who I am and what I'm putting out there, then what I end up doing is I end up falling onto my physical self as a way of navigating the world. So my physical self becomes the steps that I'm using to navigate the world instead of actually recognizing that my physical self changes through life. And that's actually a bracha. It's a bracha to age, right? It's a bracha that we have to really appreciate. We forget that, I think, in today's day and age. And so we have to remember that if our core is strong, then we will be able to sustain all those moving pieces. I say that for our kids, but I say that for ourselves also, right? It's a tall order, right? No matter who we are, we're surrounded by people. And no matter what interaction you have with other kids, other adults, we are role modeling something out there. The way we talk, the way we act, the way we behave, the way we eat, all these aspects. This is the best quote. This quote, my original supervisor in Israel, told me at this point, I think like 18 years ago, when I first started learning about eating disorders, she said, we look in the mirror and we see how we feel, not what we are. When you feel like you've done something awesome, you catch a glance of yourself, you feel like you look awesome. It's really true. Like, you feel like you have it together. And then there's a moment where you feel like, in theory, nothing has changed and everything is the same, but you're feeling really terrible about yourself and you put it on your body. I actually had an amazing thing happen two weeks ago, I had a client who texted me. She like was going through a transition in life. She was far from home, starting something new. Imagine like a Shana Ba'aretz, a college situation. And she texted me, because it was been a little hard. She's like, and it was out of the blue because she'd really rallied and was doing great. She said, I don't think I need that snack at the end of today. She's like, I just really, she herself was struggling with restricting. She said, I really don't think I need it. I think I overdid it today. So I said to her, tell me about today. Like, what happened today? She's like, oh, well, we were coming from the Otaif. They went down south. We didn't know we were going to go down south. And then they told us that in the morning, they woke us up and told us that's where we're going. And I said, wow, it just sounds like a day. She's like, it was a day. I was like, she's like, and I'm telling you, I'm so big. I was like, I am sure you are feeling so full of everything that happened today. And it has nothing to do with that snack that you're going to have in about 2 hours, and it has nothing to do with the lunch you had 4 hours ago. It has, and being able to articulate that, right? That she is feeling full. She is feeling, but nothing has changed about her from yesterday to today. Yesterday was fine and today it's not, because we take in everything that's around us. And when we look in the mirror, that's how we're feeling. We're soaking up our emotions. We're soaking up everything that's happening around us. And it's a hard thing to tease out. And this, to me, sums it up in so many ways. Rabbi Joey Haber actually said this past week in a wonderful shiur, if anybody doesn't listen to him, I think he's an awesome, gives really wonderful classes. He said, he was talking about chesed, and he said, it's like these wonderful siyata dishmaya moments where you're listening to something and all of a sudden you're like, oh my goodness, that's it. That's a perfect line. And I needed it for this week. He says, when you see somebody physically in need, the emotional need behind it is double. It's like, that's true. People have a lot of emotional needs, and sometimes it manifests as something physical. And it was like something such a clue in, right? Where are we meeting people? Are we just giving them something that they need physically, or is there something emotionally behind it? That's what we think about when we think about self-esteem. That's what we think about when we think about eating disorders. There's something happening on the outside, but you're telling me something that's really about what's happening on the inside. So sometimes I have to attend to the outside, because it's life-threatening or dangerous or maladaptive and not a good coping mechanism, but there's something that's happening on the inside. We want to be thinking about what's happening for our kids on the inside. It happened another thing this week. A kid said a kid was walking out the door, and she said to her mom, oh, I'm so fat. And the mom just was like deer in headlights. And she sent me an email. She's like, I didn't know what to say to that. I was like, I totally hear you. I also wouldn't know what to say to that. I was like, but the good thing is that you can circle back. You can go back to that kid in the moment, come back to them later in the day and say, oh my goodness, sounded like it was a really rough morning. Like, tell me what was going on. She circled back. The kid's like, I did say that this morning? I have no idea. The mom's like, oh, I'm sideways already. But like, that's what happens. She was having a rough morning. She was overwhelmed. She was stressed. There is something to think about. Why is that her go-to? Why is that her go-to language? But we're teasing out something that's happening for them, and it's getting placed on the outside, because that's such an easier place to put it. It's harder for kids to place it on the inside. It's harder for adults to place it on the inside. Okay, I'm going to run through this one, and then I'm going to pause. Okay, I think this is just kind of important. I just want to like put it out there and just kind of frame it, because I think it is related to body images. I think that, like, basically the working theory on this completely is that I want people to take away from is that kids see what parents eat. That's what it comes down to. Like, they role model what we're eating. Then parents always say to me, well, does that mean I have to eat like a 14-year-old? No, it doesn't mean like you have to eat like a 14-year-old. But there is something to be really mindful about what we're projecting to the kids, to our kids, and to our people around us, regardless of how old we are, regardless of how old they are. And I think we want to be mindful. I usually get a lot of flack for this, but I'm going to say it anyways. I want to think that we want to be mindful about extremes. Extremes never work. Right? And so what we're actually going for is helping our kids to maintain a normal weight within range that's appropriate for them, and that's not about on either extreme. And so one of the things we know is when something is limited to a specific time period, kids end up feeling like they can never have it again. And so it sets them up on a binge cycle. And so we really want to reduce it. I've become kind of like, I guess, somewhat notorious, I wouldn't call it famous, over the years for talking about like the Shabbos cereal phenomena. I hate it. Like, people like usually like are like, you let your kids have like tricks all week long. I promise you, I do. I let my kids have tricks all week long. It is true. But my kids don't always choose tricks, because sometimes they're in the mood for it and sometimes they're not in the mood for it. And I've always found that when I forget to buy things, the example I always gave, since I usually run a little like research subject in my house from time to time, is that when we moved actually to Riverdale, there was Dunkin' Donuts. We bought a lot of donuts. It disappeared within like the first 2 weeks. I was like, this is going to be an interesting one. But about on week three, I was throwing donuts out. And it was just such a fascinating thing that like when kids have more access to it. Now, that doesn't mean that they're always going to make good decisions. There are some kids who don't know how to make good decisions. There are some kids where you have to be able to say, you had three, you had two, let's put it in a baggie, let's put it off to the side, you can have more tomorrow, right? So some kids need more intervention. They need us to help teach them. But the way to teach them is not to say, never have it. You can't have it. That's not good for you. And that we've seen over and over again. The research is there. It also connects to this body image piece because our kids are subtly getting this very clear message. Would we be saying the same thing if it was a cucumber? Would we be saying the same thing if it's a carrot? And what does it mean about our bodies? You said it to me, but you didn't say it to her. How come I was saying it to me, but you didn't say it to that kid? It becomes a whole narrative, and kids as mind readers is real. I always like kind of come back to this piece. Like, if you're not articulating it, they're articulating it for themselves. They're either right or they're wrong. Usually they're wrong. Like, that's what I find more often than not. They've kind of put a spin and a narrative on it that you actually didn't necessarily want them to have. But now, because I left it out there, then it either becomes scarier. It's true with anything like trauma related. It becomes bigger. It becomes scarier in their heads. Or they create their own narrative around it, and you don't know about it until you're already so much further in, and you could have, like, mended it earlier. And again, going back to this idea of just coming back to it, right? If you say something in the morning, or you notice something as your kid's walking out the door, and it takes you a day or 2 days to puzzle it, who cares? Like, we're people, we're human. We're not going to catch it on the first time. We're going to make mistakes. Just circle back. I noticed you said this, or I noticed you gave me a funny look as I was walking out the door. Or you might have overheard me saying this and this, and I was having a moment. And that's really wasn't like a great moment of mine. And it's something I'm working on. We can be a little bit more in that capacity, circling back and real and honest with our kids. But I think recognizing this is so hard. And I think it's hard. We are people, we're living in this world. And so I think it's something that's just reality. This is always a question I get. How do I manage various food needs in one house? I think if you kind of come back to this piece, which is there's a general understanding of how we're supposed to eat that everybody kind of gets on board to, then I think it usually starts to even out, right? Because if I'm making food for this kid but not for that kid, I'm already going to find myself in a real quandary. Versus if I just made this for everybody and everybody has access to it, then we're helping our kids navigate some of those pieces. So in other words, we want to stop and think about it, right? Do I want anybody, and I think what ends up happening for parents is, well, do I want anybody having a snack at 4:30 when I'm about to serve dinner at 5 o'clock? The answer probably is no, right? But when you're tired, which we all are, and we're busy, and we want to avoid a fight, when the kid who flies in at 4:30, who you've decided is allowed to have that snack, ask for a snack, you're like, fine, it's fine, whatever. And the kid who maybe you think you don't want them to have that snack, you're like, no, you have to wait till dinner. They're not stupid, right? They see that there's a discrepancy. Instead of just holding the line for everybody, because everybody can wait until we have dinner at 5 o'clock, and it actually doesn't matter. It's just that it's like a random time to eat a snack. Or alternatively, they just walked in the door from school and they're gonna have to wait. And they need to be, you know, I feel like kids are like plants. They need to be watered and sunlight and fed. They're going to start to lose their mind. You're going to ask them to do a lot of hard things, homework, not fight with their siblings, showers, baths, all those things. You might decide, okay, it's snack time. But then it's snack time for everybody, right? So these are these things that we kind of tussle with and think about. And I do want to push parents to think about the way they talk about their bodies. I want to push parents, I want to push grandparents, I want to push all people, teachers are like a big one, to think about how we talk about our bodies, the way we talk about ourselves, and the way that makes a difference in terms of how kids pick up those messages, because those messages are more powerful. I'm not minimizing the TikTok, and I'm not minimizing the Instagram, I'm not minimizing the social media, which everyone is talking about, and it's real, but actually they know those people. On some level, some of those kids, or we can talk to those kids about those people not being role models in our life and not being meaningful. But then what happens when they go and everybody's talking about how important it is to not be eating this and to be doing that and to be looking like this and to wear clothes from there, and that is who they are defined by, right? We think about it even like with shidduchim, right? So we think about that, then that message is more powerful because it's coming from us, and we are supposed to have those same values as that we're giving over to our kids. And that's why our voices are so much more powerful. We have to own those voices. It's a responsibility. We want it. But then we really have to think about what that means. It doesn't mean that there's perfection, but it gets really challenging and it gets really sticky. And I don't think there's a difference in this area for girls and boys, right? Because we're asking them about who they want to be and what character traits we want them to have and what their values are as they go through the world. And it doesn't have to be that we're minimizing one without raising up the other one. This is actually my most favorite picture. I love this. It says, "You'll be too much for some people. Hint, those aren't your people." I love this for so many reasons. It's truly one of my favorites. My kids know it. I have one kid who, like, this to me is like it. Like, really just like, they are just out there, and they are wonderful, and they are big, and they will be too much for some people. And that's okay. And that's, like, a wonderful thing. I think it also speaks to the fact that, particularly, at least I think about this, and it relates so much to body image, is that in 6th, 7th, and 8th, and 9th grade, and 10th grade, when you're finding your friends, one of the things, I think I mentioned this last time, but it's worth mentioning again, I talk to kids about, is sometimes we make choices of friendships because we want to be with that crowd, but it's actually not a good crowd of people for us. They don't make us feel good about ourselves. We are constantly asking ourselves, are they talking about me? Are they leaving me out? And then there's a moment as parents where we say, you know, who you are should be really loved by the people you choose to be around. Not everyone's going to love it about you. And then those aren't your people. And that's okay. But find your people, find yourself, know yourself, find your people, and settle into it, right? There's like such a relief in a very odd way. Well, maybe not odd, depends on your perspective. When your kid comes home and says, "Yeah, I am not with the cool people." I'm like, thank God, because you are not cool. I was like, you are a lot of amazing, wonderful, awesome things. But that's not one. And so really gravitating towards finding your people that are really a wonderful match for you. It doesn't mean you have to be similar, but there's something about like starting to learn to grow, to know yourself, and helping our kids to give them permission to grow, to know themselves. I just saw this, and I thought this was so smart. Completely transparently, I actually basically cut and pasted because I was like, this is all the things that we want for body image. It was taken from an article, actually, about body positivity movement. It's not all that positive on TikTok. There was like a whole idea that people on TikTok were promoting positive body image, and it was like totally not true. No surprise, not true. In fact, I just found out this week that Pinterest is the only social media site that has successfully banned weight loss ads. I thought that was actually really interesting. And it was interesting to hear, like, I had some teenage girls around Shabbat, and it was interesting to hear them talk about how savvy they've become a little bit. One kid said, "I know it's really not good for myself, so I've limited myself to 1 hour a day." Like, the idea that our kids are, we're having these conversations enough that our kids are self-limiting themselves is very thoughtful. But I liked these were six very clear aspects of what promotes body image. Body appreciation. Okay, body appreciation is getting a tremendous amount of research, and I think it's actually something that we as parents have the most control over and impact on, and I actually think as religious Jews, we have a leg up on. There's a great book by Shira Smiles. It's called Rise and Aspire. I have it sitting. Rise and Aspire, yes. She basically goes through all Birchot HaShachar, and she was talking about that in the Gemara and Brachot when it's first brought up. It used to be, you opened your eyes, you would make the bracha pokeach hirim. You got dressed, as you were getting dressed, you said a bracha. Nowadays, we don't do that, and it's all been condensed. We say Birchot HaShachar altogether. But that is the original essence of body appreciation. Look what my body can do. It can do so many wonderful, amazing things. When we are much more positive about our bodies, we, by and large, feel much better about them as a whole because we're not constantly critical of them. You might still be critical of it from time to time, but if the criticism is smaller than the positivity, then we're moving in the right direction. And it's not just about a fake thing of like, I don't care what I look like, it doesn't matter to me. It's actually about what my body can do, strength, intelligence, creativity, all these other aspects there's a lot of good research to show that, like, drawing, journaling are all really positive things that help body, meditating, body appreciation. You're focusing on your body in a way that is profoundly less critical. Body acceptance and love, conceptualizing beauty broadly. These pieces, I think a lot of it have to do with the way that we talk about our bodies, talk about the people around us, talk about the ways in which we take in other people. So when I originally, there was an article, it was an article in 2011, I think it was, about how we have to stop telling people that they look pretty. That was the general rule. When you see your three-year-old, you will not say to her, "You look so pretty." So you're supposed to say, anybody? "You look so smart," even though they may not be, because they're three. Or, "You look really bright." There was all these different things that you were supposed to say. And I just saw a woman who wrote a kind of rant. She was like ranting about it. And she was like, "I don't think it has to be an either or." She's right. Like, we can tell, if we don't tell our children that they are beautiful and that they are creative and that they are stunning and that they are strong, who else will, right? Like, we are the core. But then we also have to be able to tell them that beauty is inside and out, and they are thoughtful and they are kind. And when they help their brother, you know, walk across the street, that was so thoughtful and generous and kind. It's that catching them being good, right? So we can't always protect against the negative body image. It's there. It's real, right? If I stood up here and said, "You could cure that. You could totally get rid of that," you would kind of look at me and say, "I don't think we should listen to anything this woman has to say. It's just not, it's not true." That's like a la-la land, right? We're going to be critical. But the question is are we giving our kids enough of a sense of who they are and what we think is so special about them and that we think is so unique about them? And are we helping them cultivate it? Are we sending them to schools that help them cultivate it, that they therefore can be able to recognize that they are stronger than just that outside body? Because that's what we find. What we find is when we tear it down, the kids who are really struggling with body image, they don't have so much else inside their brain. A teenager said it to me so well. She said, "Yeah, 80% of my brain space is taken up being critical about my body and what I should be eating." And I was like, "What's the other 20%? She's like, "Anxiety. Like, anxiety about everything else, right? But, like, it's so small about all the wonderful things that they are, right? When I ask a person with a healthy sense of self, "Give me 5 good things you feel really good about today," people can list it, right? It might be a good exercise, but they can do it. When we ask people who are struggling with body image, which is why it's so connected to depression, give me five things, I got nothing. It's crickets. One is really hard, and it could just be showing up. Showing up and trying, and I said good morning to my mother, and it could be something small, but it's really hard to cultivate, and so it's really important. Inner positivity, protective filtering of information is actually really important. I like this one because I think that it also goes back to parenting in terms of like our and being adults in the world. It goes back to like your kids are going to be seeing lots of things. Some we can control and some we can't control. Sometimes we try to control it, but sometimes we also can't. And being able to talk about it, whether or not it's an ideal for them, how they move past it, how they get through it, what they think about it, right? We kind of worked off the assumption for years and years that like if my kids see me doing this, then they will know that it's important for me. So if they see me davening, then they know it's important for me that they should daven. But now we've realized that that's true, and we have to talk about our values. We have to articulate them, because if we don't articulate them, then they won't know it, and then they won't be able to build it. I'm skipping this because I actually want to get to this. Okay, these are amazing artworks. And I want to just like show them to you, because the piece that I have found over and over again to be the most successful with body image and body esteem is actually art therapy. So I'm going to give you a little bit of background on this for 1 second. Years ago, high schools wanted all of us in the mental health eating disorder field to come in and talk to their high schools about eating disorders, because they wanted their eating disorder, they wanted to protect their kids of eating disorders, and they wanted us to come talk about them. What would happen is they would say, "Thank you so much for coming to our school. We've now identified 20 new eating, you know, 20 new eating disorder cases." And all of us clinicians, like, were like, "All we, you didn't find them, we created them." Like, honestly, truly, like, the kids who didn't have ideas now have ideas. And so there's been a shift and a movement to really put our foot down on this one and not be running these classic eating disorder programs. And so I think what more of us are thinking about is what builds protection from eating disorders is raising up kids' self-esteem and body image and body esteem. And what does that is by helping them articulate and identify who they are as people. Who is their inner self? When I open you up, what is inside of you? What's happening inside of you? When I first ran this program at SKA in the five towns, they said to me, there is no way these girls are going to get on the floor and draw. I was like, draw, like full-blown pieces of paper. I gave them a prompt about drawing something about themselves, what's inside their inner world, and what is happening in their brain. There was different, this is the next year where they had to do emotional jars about what was going on for them. And I said, let's try it. We don't know until we try it. The artwork that came out was amazing. I still to this day get chills looking at some of the artwork. It is fabulous. She sent me pictures of all these girls, some artistic, some not, sprawled all over, just drawing all about themselves. This is the example I use because it's the most powerful. It's a person who's really struggling with two sides of herself. And we talk about this obvious piece of it. This side of her that is so awesome and wonderful and fun, her body is flying in the air. And over here, when she's so critical on herself, it feels just like a sack of potatoes, none of which is real because she's not a sack of potatoes. She's a wonderful person who has so much character to her, but it's hard to see it, right? Even her ears and her earrings don't shine through in the side of her that's so critical of herself. And the piece that I love about this, which I talked to when I do artwork, is to look and see that the sun has darkness on it, and that's okay. Not everything about being an optimist is about roses. Sometimes it's a little, for anybody who saw Inside Out, joy has to meet sadness from time to time. It makes life meaningful, and we don't want to run away from it. That's what is eating disorders. Eating disorders is something's uncomfortable, and I don't think I can handle it inside of me, and I don't like that it's inside of me. And therefore, in order to have it not be a part of me, I'm going to shut everything down, and I'm going to push it all out. And I'm going to make it about the outside body that carries me through the world. And if that is perfect and that is acceptable, then I am acceptable. And we're teaching our kids that that's actually not true. That they are acceptable because they are bright and characteristic and creative and fun and wonderful and thoughtful and intense and sometimes sad and sometimes anxious. All these different aspects of them that are so much more. This was amazing to me. She basically talked about not being enough. This is just beyond. And this is a piece of artwork that somebody just did for me, and it is so powerful and so intense. I obviously asked her permission before I used it. I blocked out some things on there, but it's basically a girl in a base Yakov uniform with a paper bag over her head. And when I asked her what's underneath, she said me being strangled because she feels like she can't breathe because she's working so hard to be what everybody wants her to be. And when it doesn't work out, she really explodes and she does things that she wishes she hadn't done, but on behalf of feeling like it's not enough. It's really, really powerful. She happens to be an amazing artist. So when I asked her to do the next piece, which was her face behind it, it's taking us a little bit of time because she's actually like a very particular artist. But I actually thought the words were so powerful. Because there's actually nothing about her in any of these pictures. There's nothing inside of her that's actually a character trait. It's all about other people. It's about other people who are around her. It's about externalized things. There's nothing internalizing that's holding her. And so in that space, she's drowning. She's awesome. She's going to be fine. But she's struggling and she's drowning, and it's really intense. Okay, these are two more. These are really intense. She's a fabulous, okay, they're different. This is somebody who's not she's not a writer. She actually really has a hard time with language. And so I actually had her do jars because there was no way I was gonna get drawings out of her. And she actually was able to kind of put things in jars. And when you ask her how her week is, she's like, great, fine. I was like, was it? And then she kind of goes through, and in each actual box is something about eating disorders. Each one, food she's insecure about. Over here, overachieving, she's insecure about. There's food. Every space has food. And there's not, and she's an awesome kid. But trying to build up and get her to recognize those awesome aspects of her is so hard. So instead, she's externalized it. She's like, but I feel like I could just be stronger. I was like, why is that the most important thing? And on the one hand, it goes back to that idea of body appreciation. Her body can do lots of things. She's a dancer. She's a runner. She can do lots of things. On the other hand, she's also working so hard because, again, she's struggling with the fact that when she voices something about who she is, she's met with a lot of pushback because it's not exactly what her parents want her to be. That's a tough one. That's a tough one as a parent, right? Like, what if our kids are different than what we had envisioned for them to be? And in the space of them not being who we want them to be, we don't always realize, but we silence their voice. How do we, but on the other hand, are we not allowed to have an opinion? Are we not allowed to feel like we have expectations for our kids? How do we moderate those? How do we mediate those? Some of it's knowing your kid. Some of it's seeing your kid. Some of it's making a space to hear about it. But those are really complicated. This is a kid who's an amazing artist who has a really, really profound eating disorder. When I first saw her, she was 90 pounds, and now she's not. And she's doing okay. She's, you know, she's struggling through her Shanaba Arts year. She's doing okay, but you see the intensity. That is, she is dying. She desperately wants to be with everybody in it, doing what everybody else is doing. And she's totally held captive by her weight. And she's an amazing artist, and I actually think she can do her best work in therapy when she's able to use her art because it's so intense for her. And it's hard for her to be able to internalize that she's more than her weight. And she hates it. Like, this to me is so profound. She's mm-hmm. totally captivated by it, and her brain is full of it. And she feels totally controlled by it. And so this is just so spot on. And yet it's so, so, so hard. Just one second, hold on. Okay. I just want to say one thing. I'm going to skip over here for 1 second. I want to just say one thing about this. I just want to, because I'm watching the time for a second, I'm going to pause for questions. I just want to say that I think that, like, there's been a lot of, like, bad rap around Judaism and eating disorders. And that, like, we're worse at it than everybody else, and we're not giving our kids good body image, worse than anybody else. Anecdotally, I know that people feel very strongly about that. The research doesn't exactly bear it out, to be perfectly honest. It's hard to know, like, when we look at the body, like, actual eating disorder rates relative to, let's say, disordered eating rates. It's possible our disordered eating rates is higher, maybe, but our profound eating disorder rates, for the most part, seem to stay the same. There's been some machloket about it. I was listening to a podcast with Marcy Forza, who's done amazing work in the field. She's excellent. She's created wonderful body image programs that were totally in sync on this. And everyone should look for her work. She's doing amazing work in schools. I think one of the pieces people come up against is the fact that, like, there's so much food. Again, I think it's how we talk about it. I really just, like, I want to be mindful of that, right? Like, if a 3-day Yantiv is a binge fest, so then you're right. I guess that is really, and we're talking about it. If a 3-day Yantiv is time to spend time with family, and honestly, most people are rushing out the door for good or for bad. I'm acknowledging a reality. Most people are not having the largest breakfast on a Yantiv morning because they've been in shul. You're coming home. You're actually only having 2 meals. You're not having 3 meals. And it's about coming together and being together and, like, really celebrating that. I think there's something very powerful and wonderful about it. To me, the biggest research when it comes to eating disorders is not around all this idea of, like, it's because we have so much food and we have Shabbos and we have this. These are good things. These are opportunities where people are coming together and they're sharing. They are opportunities for us to show our kids, I'm having dessert and you're having dessert, and I'm having challah and you're having challah. There's a real opportunity here for us to rise above it and to think about what we're talking about at the Shabbos table and how we're getting dressed ourselves in the morning and what we're talking about. But I think that the piece I will say is that the best research I've seen was a very big longitudinal study that was done out of YU. It was done a while ago. All right, I'll leave it here and I'll pull it. That basically looked at intrinsic versus extrinsic religiosity. And what we did find, and this goes back to what I think I've been trying to like kind of drive home over and over again, is that when you have developed a identity of religion that comes from your inside as parents, in other words, your kids feel like you're engaged in a religion in an authentic way. That if you were sitting on an island and nobody could see you, you would still be waking up in the morning to daven, and you would still be making your bracha because it's about a relationship with religion. It's about a relationship with God. It feels authentic to who you are. Our kids are like lie detectors. If they think we're not being authentic, they blow it off. And that's what we've seen over and over again. When we think about religion, religion overwhelmingly is a protective factor. When we break it apart, what we find is that it's a protective factor when kids feel like it's the real deal. When they feel like what we're putting out there is really a manifestation of who we are, not because we're worried about what the neighbor is going to think, but when it's not, when it's totally externalized, it was externalized versus internal, when it's externalized, then we see that religion has no buffer effect, and if anything, we see higher rates of the things that we're trying to avoid, whether it comes to eating disorders, whether it comes to all of those pieces. And the last thing I just want to say before I just kind of run through this and take questions is that I think one of the pieces that we come back to over and over again, and I just want to put out there, in this day and age of complicated relationships with our own bodies and the world around us, not everybody who goes on a diet develops an eating disorder. But every eating disorder starts from a diet. Those are really two. Those are, you know, so we always say three boys go on a diet, one of them develops an eating disorder because of lots of variables, a million and one permutations and variables. The question becomes is what makes somebody go on a diet? I'm talking about in a restrictive way. And I think that what ends up happening is that if you have a kid who has a moment, or as people, you have a moment, you get dressed, whatever it is, you don't love the way this and whatever, and then you go about your day because you have a lot of really awesome, important, wonderful things to do, it becomes smaller. Okay, maybe, but it's smaller. You go about your day. But when you have nothing else that makes you feel good about your day, that's all you're thinking about. So we think about it for ourselves and we think about it for our kids. So everyone's going to wake up and have a day. That's okay. Everyone's going to finish a day and have a day. But the question is in between, are we really honing in and helping our kids be like, okay, you don't love the way that skirt fits. Okay, that happens from time to time. Now tell me about the rest of your day. Tell me what else you did. Because food is emotional. Our bodies are emotional and ourselves are emotional, but we're bringing our kids up, we're bringing ourselves up, and we're thinking about that. That is the biggest buffer for self-worth, and we can do it all the time. And then the last thing I just want to point out there, which I think is true, is at the end of the day, Rabbi Rosner just mentioned this in Daf Yomi last week. He was talking about inheritance. If anyone's listened to Rabbi Rosner's Daf Yomi, it's a lot of treasures, and sometimes you're not sure how you got there from the daf because it's amazing. You're here, and then you're all over the place. But he talks about the fact that at the end of the day, raising children is siyata d'shmaya. And I feel a little humility for all of us. We can do everything right, and we can try to say everything, but it really is a lot of up to God. Not to minimize what we put into it. It's a relationship. We do our part, and we hope that God does his part, but I just think parents beat themselves up also, for anybody who heard me last time. So there has to be a working relationship on that one, and recognizing our kids are their own people also. They come in with their personalities and their strengths and their weaknesses and their energies. And, and some of them are like us and some of us are really not like us. Some of them are further from our tree. Some of them are easier. And being able to know when they're not as easy for us. Everybody knows that kid who's pushing their buttons and the kid who could do exactly the same thing and never pushes our buttons. And I think being able to kind of tap into that is really important, and to give ourselves that emuna and grace. So this is what's in my latest book club shelf. I'm sharing it with you. Maybe it's helpful, maybe it's not. These are the books that I'm kind of are on my mind. I usually tell people, don't necessarily get the books, don't necessarily read the books, find a good podcast with them. I'll tell you this one. This one's Arise and Aspire by Shira Smiles. I think it's lovely and great if you have 3 minutes, 4 minutes, 5 minutes in your day. I think it enhances everyone's tefillah, and I think really has a lot of body positivity, and it's inspirational. So I encourage everyone to get it. Five Principles of Parenting. I am a somewhat parenting critic these days of the parenting, everyone's a parenting psychologist. I love Dr. Aliza Pressman. I love her. Her podcast is amazing. I think everybody should listen to it. Her book is great, but honestly, save yourself and just go listen to her podcast because it's great. And you can save yourself some money, but I really think she's awesome and she's doing great stuff. 8 Keys to Recovery from an Eating Disorder. My clients love this over and over again. And it has some great exercises in there. I actually had a client who was very reticent to try one of these books. She started it and then I bought it so we could do some of it together. And I use it all the time. I like their prompts. I think they have good journal writing prompts. I think they have good drawing writing prompts. I think it's excellent. Why is my child in charge? This has nothing to do with eating disorders. This is a great book. And Dr. Aliza Pressman actually interviewed this psychologist, and I thought it was so spot on, and I think it actually is really thoughtful and can help thinking about all aspects of parenting, which also our body image and self-esteem, which is helping ourselves to set up ourselves for success as parents. And so often the guilt of being not enough causes us to make really bad decisions. So the classic one is, my kid, I want to have I was working all day. I want to have a sweet bedtime moment with my kid because I'm feeling bad and I really want them to have this wonderful moment. They want me to read 5 books. I have 5 minutes. I want to read 1 book, but I feel really bad. So I'm going to negotiate and read 5, but then it deteriorates because they need 5 and a toothbrush and another bathroom. And then you yell because it's now 45 minutes later. But if you had just stuck to your 1, you would have had a great bedtime moment. And that would have been so awesome. But we don't, because we cave. And so kind of all those little moments that happen over and over again, she talks about it, and it's great. When your teen has an eating disorder, if you're in it, this is a great book. I think it's small, as you can see, relative to all the other books, and I like small books for anyone who's a parent and struggling with an eating disorder because you don't have time to read and you need to just open it and be like, oh, that 5 sentences is really good, and then close it and feel like you got something. That would be it. This is just, you gotta consume it. You don't have to agree with it. Abigail Schreier has a lot of podcasts. You can go listen to the podcast and get the cliff notes because you can see it's really big. She makes some important points about, are we sending our kids to therapy too much? I'm putting my own business out of business here. I don't think she's right about everything, but I think she pushes us to ask some good questions about when we're outsourcing our parenting. At least to be mindful of the questions that are out there. And I think it just behooves us to think about a different perspective on it. What's Eating Us is great. Cole Kasdan, it's a really great book. It's actually not so big. The Fairburn book is just, it's a classic in the world of eating disorders. If you're a clinician, you should get it. This, unfortunately for me, was my second one because when I went to give a lecture somewhere, someone said, do you know CBTE? And I was like, I do, but I don't know where my book is. And then it turns out that I had been trained in CBTE because in Israel they were ahead of the curve and that was all they did and I was trained by an Israeli. So that was my first book that I had and now I wasted money and got a beautiful brand new copy. And my other one is somewhere lost. But it is here and it is good and it is excellent and he is an excellent clinician and everyone should know about some of these books. So that was where I wanted to leave it. I didn't cover everything, but I'm going to pause because it's 9 o'clock and it's a Sunday night. Questions, comments, thoughts? Yes. Good. I did it intentionally. Do I have something to say about it? How long do you have? Look, I'll tell you something. I happen to feel very mixed on this, okay? I think that there are clients that I have worked with that are truly suffering from binge eating disorder, and they have really tried so many things, and so I think the answer is it's complicated. I think that for the right population, it's really important because for some people, they are working so hard to be more mindful about their food and they get hijacked. They get hijacked and they're honest about it and will be like, I had a really bad day and I came home and ate a pie of pizza That's not balanced. That's not moderate. That's not within the range of you get to pick your weight as long as it's within a healthy range and you're going to have a moderate range of food. That's a totally different category. And I've really expanded my thought over the years. I really originally, as a young, kind of naive clinician, was like, listen, everybody can just be moderate. Everyone will be fine. And it's not fair. It's not true. That being said, I am somewhat vocally critical of moms who are using it, and I'm using that specific population, to try to create their bodies to be 20-year-olds. Like, you're not. It's okay. We're 40 and 50 and 60, and we know that the eating disorder rates are rising in that population. And I also think it's a bad message for kids. In addition to the fact that I knew the question was going to come up, so I just went back to look. People can't stay on the drugs forever. So my sister-in-law, who works actually as a PA in Maryland, runs a whole portion of a clinic. And she herself will tell you that these, like any diet that exists out there, 90% of people who go on a diet lose weight only to regain weight after a period of time after plus 5 pounds, instead of just trying to find a balanced way of eating, which is moderate exercise, moderate eating with all aspects of it. And I think that that's hard for people. So people are constantly yo-yoing, but the diet drugs to some degree are proving to be the same thing. Unless you're staying on them for the foreseeable inevitable future, which people can't do financially. And also we don't know what the medical implications are of it. Forget about the messaging that we're sending to our kids. I think it's problematic, without being overly judgy. And also because the truth is, there is to some degree a look, like you can see for the most part when someone's on it. And I don't believe that kids don't see and don't know. And so I guess, again, it goes back to this question of what are we role modeling to our kids over and over again, that this is so important above all else. I think it's really complicated. So yeah, I'm not loving it, not loving it, but I think there's a place for it. I just think there's a place for it, and people have to be honest about why they're using it. And as a result of it, we're going to move away from normalcy. Nobody's going to be able to tolerate being a normal person with a normal body. The same way that there's a place for plastic surgery, and then there's a place for you seeing women really working hard to basically take away themselves. I didn't quote this, but in Cole Kasdan's book, she has this moment where she's looking through a photo album of her child's life, and she realizes there's no pictures of her. And her kid is little still. And she says, there's one picture because her husband asked for her approval of it, because the one time he didn't, she lost her mind on him. And she realized that she'd been editing herself out of her child's life because of she didn't like this picture, and she didn't like this picture, and she liked the way she looked in this picture. And the reality is, Halavai, we all look back and we're not even seeing that, right? You look at a picture of yourself, you see a moment in time. And so we have to think about that. You look back and you see something that's really wonderful with your kid. You're not thinking about how you look. You're thinking about that smile in that moment, but it's hard to remember that in the moment. So what are we editing out on behalf of that? And never mind the fact though, sorry, one more thing on this fact. Okay. Never mind the fact that the gut is where we hold happiness. And so there was a lot of research to say, are people who are taking some of these drugs have increased depression? That was a question that was out there at the time. I don't think there's been enough research on it, so I don't have the answer what the research is showing. My hypothesis at the time on this was that for people who really need this drug to help them for their binge eating and obesity that's causing them physical and medical complications, they're still eating. This is just a support. They're still getting that food into their stomach that makes them feel good and happy and alive. But for people who are using it to further starve themselves, they are more depressed because they're working on nothing. They're not feeding. They're using it as a way to help them eat less and less. So I think that's where you're going to see some of those pieces to it. I mean, I think the jury's out because, we're at the beginning of it. So I don't know. I think insurance companies aren't happy about it also. That's what I hear. It's a rumor on the street. Okay, what else? after I was so non-opinionated about that question. Thoughts, questions? Yes.
You mentioned Shidduchim briefly. I was wondering if you could talk about, like, obviously there's so much about how, like, we think about ourselves, how we raise our kids to think about themselves, and how that affects how they eat, but about how they view other people, like, thinking about, like, I just don't, like, I've tried to set up some of my friends, and guys were like, I don't like the way she looks for XYZ reason. Like, is there a way for us to, I guess, raise kids to be less judgy of other people, too, when it comes to their physical nature, or that's just...
So I'll tell you, I feel like, again, there's like a human nature piece, right? Like, and the truth is, Shidduchim's complicated. We want people to be attractive to the person that they're going on a date with. I'm going to give my sister-in-law props right now. She has two boys dating, and she said to her boys, no pictures. She's like, you're not taking, and she's not so Harish. She said, no pictures. She's like, you have to be attractive to the person that you are dating, but I want you to go and meet this person in real, in time, and see what they are, all of them, right, to this point around body image, what they look like, and how they are, because that impacts how we take somebody in. So I do think we can do better. That doesn't mean to say that we're not saying it's important, but we're actually just putting our finger on the fact that, like, we're articulating a value. Yes, you should be attracted to this person, and attraction comes in lots of different forms. So it's like somebody who's like, you know, it's like my roommate. She's like, I have to marry someone tall. Her husband's short, P.S. Like, you know, like, no, seriously, you know, we always like joke. But she went on a date and she met him. He's not the tallest person. She came back and was like, I guess I'll wear flats. Like, there is something about this idea that you meet somebody and you take them in. And it's, you're not always, you know, you kind of allow yourself that space and grace. But we don't do that when we have the objectivity of 10 pictures in front of me. Okay, so obviously then I'm not going to do that. So I think that we can do better without being so, you know, so lofty. That would be, I think, and I think we can talk about it that way, right? And I think the more we talk about it, the more, I think the better off that we are. And if you can't get to that point, I would ask this question of, like, and, okay, what other core values are you looking for in somebody else? Like, why would somebody want to go on a date with you? Like, what are you bringing to the table? I could tell you as your mother what you're bringing to the table, but what do you think you're bringing to the table? I think it expands their awareness and thought process about who they are and what they're looking for in a very thoughtful way. I think in some ways it's challenging because, you know, there is this panic, which I think is part of the problem. Like, we're panicking our kids around this Shidduchim crisis. If you're panicked, then you make a bad choice because you think that in order to solve for this thing that you're never going to achieve, that therefore you need to be exactly like the person next to you. It's actually undoing everything you talked about tonight. Don't have too many opinions. Don't talk too loud. Don't walk too loud. Just kind of tap it down, you know, and be like everybody else, and that will be the way out of this. And I think that, like, that is a place. And then the other piece, I just saw Rabbi Goldman's actually on Motzei Shabbos, and I said, I used to work with Rabbi Goldman's when I worked in Ramaz. He was the principal in Ramaz, and his wife at a Shabbaton that we were on, she said something to me, and I actually said to him on Motzei Shabbos, I quote her all the time, and this was a long time ago at this point, at least 10 plus years. She said, if you as a parent don't believe that your child is going to get married, then they won't. Because if you don't believe it, if you don't think that they're awesome, everybody else can doubt it. I don't know, she's being picky. Did she really want to go to that school? Does she really want to put that picture on? Someone else can say it, but if you as a mom are not your kid's biggest advocate and cheerleader, they will feel it, and that is the most important to them. So I think that, like, as parents, we have to be our kid's biggest cheerleader in the sense that we believe that they are good, and we believe that we love them and somebody else will love them because we see who they are, not because of who they're trying to be. And I think that is really powerful. So, and I think it's a work, you know, a work in progress.
It seems like some people in the medical world maybe are not, like, super in tune, like, maybe pediatricians or everything. Like, so how do you advise someone who their child is struggling with their weight, they're overweight, the doctor telling them they're overweight, they tell them to go to a nutritionist, and, like, how to prevent that from spiraling into, it's all your fault, you have a terrible body, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
We love those pediatricians. It's so funny because I just saw like a million new pilot. Before I do these, I'm like, I like take them in and I'm like, I really should scavenge all the new research. So now I'm basically covered for the year, people. Like, I basically covered like 5 journals in the last like week. But it looks like there's like a lot of new pilot programs being piloted around medical professionals having to be taught how to be better in this whole area. And it's what's fascinating to me is that they totally, like, I just got a call from a pediatrician completely freaking out about a weight that was too low. And I'm thinking to myself, but you didn't call, honestly, you didn't call me when it was a little too low, because that's okay. That's not so bad, right? You only called me when it was really low. And you were harassing the kid when she was overweight, or you perceived her to be overweight, or you perceived her to be over her whatever, instead of actually like being really thoughtful about it. So I really find the pediatrician piece to be really challenging. I think as parents, we have a right to stay ahead of it. And to like call the pediatrician in advance and just be like, listen, I just want to tell you, this is what's going on. If you want to talk to me about it, you can talk to me about it, but I really don't want you talking to my child about it. Like, there's no good research to show that kids who go to nutritionists long-term do better off. If anything, they get angry. They feel really judged. They end up being kind of like throwing like a little bit of like a curse word at the parent and doing exactly the opposite. You wanted me to do this? Forget it. I'm really mad and I'm going to do the opposite of what you want. And all that ends up happening is like raging eating disorders that is so much further and deeper than they would have just been out of the gate. When as a parent, you're like, okay, I'm going to keep an eye on it. Like, I'll help my kid. Like, I'll see where she's like, is she constantly having like a snack at a random hour? Or like, we can figure this out. We're like all smart, intelligent people with food. We do this all the time. I think what ends up happening is like it just becomes a big spiral. And I also happen to think that like this is my own bias, but like I really think that like pediatricians unintentionally, particularly in this day and age, are just not mindful of the reality that like kids going through from like ages 8 to 16, their weight's going to look wonky. It's mm-hmm. just going to. Sometimes it's going to look under. Sometimes it's going to be off their curve, on their curve, this, that, and the other thing. Have you ever looked at your kids' math scores? Like, they're also all over the curve. Like, this one's math and this one's reading. I don't know. Like, it goes in waves. And, like, some of it's developmental and some of it's where they're up to. This is, like, just in their bodies. And we don't know because we haven't seen them on the finish line of this. We have no idea what their bone age scan unless you, like, have gone down that whole rabbit hole and started checking their bone age scan. But we don't know any of those things. So I kind of wish, in some level, they would be less conservative, actually, like be a little more on top of it when you see kids rapidly decreasing their weight, which they're not, because that's perfectly fine for them until it's not and they're in a full-blown panic, and really hold back a little bit on kids' weight going up and down, because I just think it creates such a bad dynamic. That's just my, and I just like really, to me, it's like, I think it's coming from a good place. Like, I believe it's coming from a good place. I think they're trying to be helpful and stay ahead of it. I just think they don't realize, like, what little word comes out. And the you hear it all the time, but my pediatrician told me. And if you're in it and you couldn't control for it, you as the parent, even if you're in that hijack moment of, like, what do I say now, you have to circle back to it and just be like, I want to talk about what she just said. Tell me how you're feeling. Even if you want to, like, you know, kind of run and hide and, like, just disappear from that moment, but, like, and find your best book or wine, whatever it is at your moment, but, like, you got to kind of lean into it, even if it's a day later. Like, I was really taken aback by what the pediatrician says. Let's talk about it. Even if you don't have the answers.
What about with younger children, especially when you have... We're talking about like the balance in the family and different kids need different things, where you might have one kid who's like the pickiest eater and just getting them to have 3 bites is a lot. And then maybe the sibling just finds the most happiness with a big plate of pasta. Like, where, like, because you want to promote that, but you also want to promote balance and not be like, why are you telling her to eat more? Why are you telling her to have any... word
yeah,
advice.
Two words. I'm going to give 2 words on this. One is, I think that like we have to aim for some amount of evenness at the end. At the same time, as my kids know, our house is not a democracy and we don't treat our children equal. Like there's no, everyone's different and everybody gets different things and that's okay. Some kids get, kids get what they need, not what the other kid got. That's reality because somebody else is going to get the same thing, right? If one kid's dyslexic, they're going to get a reading specialist, but the other kid who's not isn't going to have a reading, like that's just kind of reality, right? Different kids have different strengths and different kids need different help. I think the piece where it gets a little bit wonky is the kid who's a picky eater, I don't want that kid eating three full plates of whatever it is. It doesn't have to be pasta. It could be carrots. I don't want them eating all of that either. And so I think that, like, if we're able to adjust our brain, which I think happens with picky eating, which is because it's the most stressful. Picky eating feels extraordinarily stressful. It's, like, exhausting. But if we came at it from a different perspective, which is, like, I don't want anybody under-eating. I don't want anybody overeating. We just need to all find the middle space. Then I think there's a place where you are able to find a little bit more of an even-handed space to it, right? I think that's number one. I think the piece you want to avoid is for the kid who's a picky eater. Sometimes what we end up doing is letting them just snack all day because we're like, oh God, like they're not going to eat anything. So like, just eat what you can when you can, and then I'm gonna ignore it. Instead of it being that everybody has the same rule at the table. Everybody has to come to the table. Everybody has to try it. You may not like it. You know, as my kids will tell you, Wednesday night fish in my house, some kids still don't like it, and yet I still serve it. But like, that's just how it rolls. And like, they will come around to like
it. And if they don't like the fish, do they have a bowl of cereal?
Okay, so cereal to me is a funny thing. Even though I am a Shabbos cereal like winner, I don't like cereal for dinner meals. Cereal is a breakfast food, and I feel like cereal has become this thing that's like, I'm not hungry, I'm going to have a bowl of cereal. Why? I don't know. It's like, cereal is a breakfast food. I don't even think it fills kids up, to be perfectly honest. I just think, like, the notoriety of it. I tend to be like, you have to try it. If you really don't like it, you can make yourself a yogurt or you can make yourself an egg, but I'm not jumping through hoopla and kind of really being able to like limit it to some degree, but I think everybody has to try it for the most part. I do think, and I say this to parents where they're struggling with a kid who's anorectic, and I say the same thing in any spectrum. Don't set yourself up for failure and don't set your kids up for failure. If you know your kid is going to lose their mind don't do it. I mean, like, again, if it's everything and you're never doing it, and you might have a week that's like the week of rice. I don't know what to tell you, but I'm just using that as an example. We're like, okay, you know you're going to be serving rice and everybody knows that's what's on the menu and we're all going to push ourselves to have rice that week. Whatever. It's not such a... But it might be hard depending on where you come from. So like whatever it is, I think then you've given everybody a little expectation. Here's where we're headed. Here's where we're going. And then I think having everybody try it. But I also think like, so set yourself up. If you're making chicken, you might say everybody has to try this type of chicken. And I also have Ouf Tov animal chicken for whoever is going to be picky on round two. I think there's a way to modulate it a little bit where you're asking kids to try it. I also, just as a word to the wise when it comes to picky eating, if you have kids who are getting lunch in school, okay, and they're eating perfectly fine in school, you don't hear about it. You get on the parent-teacher conference, you're like, they eat the best lunch. Really? Because it was like corn soup. And they're like, they had tons of bowls of it. And you're like, that's funny because they won't touch any of my food. It is basically a parent thing, right? They know that they're exhausting you and you have to make a decision. Are you going to cave to it or are you not going to cave to it? But like also kind of like, you know, as my pediatrician said, one good meal a week, not so bad. Like, okay, like what's the worst thing that happens? They go to bed hungry? I'm serious. Like really? Like, okay, that's your choice. If I were you, I would eat the food that's not amazing. Because not every food has to be amazing. That's like an eating disorder rule. Every time I eat something, it has to be the most amazing thing. Otherwise, it's not worth it. That's not true. Sometimes it's just fine. Sometimes it's fine. Sometimes it tastes good. Sometimes it tastes bad. Sometimes it's just what's in front of me. It's dinner time. I got to eat. And so you don't like it? I don't know what to tell you. Okay, good news. Please God, you'll eat again in a few hours. I think like that's kind of that stance around it a little bit. Yeah, I'm going to take one more last question. Okay.
Need to go on a diet, I need to lose weight, and they've heard, you know, there is some reality to it because the pediatrician has told them maybe they are a little bit overweight. How, like, what's the best way to respond to that? Like,
So I think there's a couple things. First of all, I would really want to get, that's what I tell parents all the time. I don't think there's one right answer. That's the first thing I want to just say. Second thing is, I want you to get curious. Like, wow, that feels really like a lot. Like, how does that make you feel? Like, it makes me upset to hear you talking. First of all, I'd be curious to know, like, where is that coming from? Where did you hear that? Why would you, do you feel okay about it? Like, there are lots of different ways to describe people, right? Like, sometimes you don't want to put onto that child that is a negative thing to say. Maybe they just said, oh, so-and-so called me fat. So instead of jumping in, right, as a parent, let's say your kid comes home in tears, or not in tears, so-and-so called me fat, okay? As a parent, I think my initial thing would be like devastated, right? Like, oh my God, because I'm having my reaction, I'm having my feelings about it. But now I'm taking that back for a second, I'm just saying, wow, tell me how you felt about it. Did you say something back to the kid? What do you think it meant? Did it bother you? Do you feel okay about it? Like, I would just start to get a little bit curious, right? If you had a kid that was really upset and sad, I think what I would actually want to reflect to them is, you know, Hashem made us in lots of different sizes, and our most important thing is that we're living a healthy lifestyle. And that is actually what we need to be doing, right? And the rest of it is kind of going to be how we're supposed to be. Not everybody is meant to be one size, just like not everybody's meant to be creative, and not everybody's meant to be a singer, and not everybody's meant to be a basketball player. We're all really different, and we're gonna use our bodies in lots of different ways. And everyone has different things that they feel really great about. Some people love their hair color, and some people love their hairstyle, and some people love that they can sing. Everybody has different things about their body. I would start to, and then I would actually cue it. Tell me what else you love about you. Like, I would start to pull for all those things that, like, we talked about a little bit, and then she might come back to it, or he. I know, but this is really hard for me, and I feel so upset, right? There might be a space to say, well, tell me how I can help you, and then be able to, like, make sure that it's a moderated healthy. I don't think the answer would be a nutritionist, because it's not rocket science. It's just eating moderately and exercising moderately. And then when kids do that, they're fine. It's us who messes them up 99% of the time. No, seriously, in that sense, we mess them up, right? Like, you have to eat this to have dessert. We automatically make one food good and one food bad, right? We do all of these things, right? Like, don't have too many carbs. Well, why not? Like, you need carbs to do lots of different things. You want to run a marathon, you want to be awake in school, you want to do all those things, you need to have a good breakfast. We make all these decisions, and sometimes we do them silently, right? My kids, my high schoolers, they hate breakfast. It's like, I don't know what it is, just like a thing. Like, you turn into high school, you don't have breakfast. Like, it's like a struggle, but how can we stop them and be like, you need breakfast, and then they eat weird breakfast. I'll just take a random thing. Like, why? But that's this tug of war that we have to do. And oh, by the way, it's across the board. Everywhere, it's like one of the things I spend the most time on is helping kids figure out breakfast. Okay, you have to figure it out. It's not perfect. But I think if we're doing it, then we're putting our finger on it. So I think it's complicated, and I think you want to circle back to it. I'm going to stop, but I think you want to circle back to it. Like, a week later, how are you feeling about it? Once it's out in the room, you're not creating it. Parents think if you don't talk about it, you're creating it. But once it's there, so then you have to talk about it. By not talking about it, then you're just kind of putting your head in the sand because it feels so overwhelming. Instead of just knowing you're going to bumble your way through it and you're going to come back to it, right? Okay, I'm going to pause. But I'm going to stay for a few minutes. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me. I hope everybody wanted. So, okay, I just like I, you know, I always like to feel like I didn't get to everything.
I know. No.
Okay.
My name is Lash Bengal.
Hi, how are you?
I work at Fresh as a nurse.
Oh, hi. So nice to meet you.
Oh,
so
I don't go anywhere, so I don't get anywhere. So, I mean, it's not. No, it's hoping that you can.